What the hell is going on right now? And why is it happening like this? At Wired, we're obsessed with getting to the bottom of those questions, and maybe you are too. I'm Katie Drummond, the Global Editorial Director of Wired, and I'm hosting our new podcast series, The Big Interview. Each week, I'll sit down with some of the most interesting, provocative, and influential people who are shaping our right now. Listen to The Big Interview right now in the same place you find Wired's Uncanny Valley podcast.
''92-year-old Paul Biya gets a new term as president of Cameroon. He says his work is not done. His opponents have taken to the streets.
If in 40 years you haven't done what you promised to do, what kind of energy do you have left?
I'm Marco Werman. Today, what protests over contested election results in Cameroon are really about. Also, in Jamaica, people are bracing for Hurricane Melissa.
The amount of rainfall we're expected to get will be catastrophic.
Confronting a Category 5 storm. Plus, many indigenous groups choose to remain isolated from the rest of the world. A new report says their future is grim.
They're not living in ignorance. They're well aware of the colonizing forces that are trying to take over their land, and they are making an active choice to reject that.
And the King of England memorializes LGBTQ military veterans today on The World. This is The World. I'm Marco Werman. Thank you for making it today. Carolyn Beeler has the day off. We start the show with Hurricane Melissa, which is churning through the Caribbean as we speak. Residents of Jamaica, Haiti, Cuba, the Bahamas, and other nearby islands are bracing for a catastrophic impact. The storm has intensified into a Category 5 hurricane, the highest level on the Saffir-Simpson scale. It's expected to make landfall in Jamaica tonight or early tomorrow, bringing with it a deluge of rain and serious destruction. Jamaica's Prime Minister, Andrew Holness, addressed the nation earlier.
Prepare your evacuation plan and comply with the evacuation orders given.
As Jamaicans grappled with those warnings today, we got climate scientist Michael Taylor on the line. He's in Kingston, where he heads the Faculty of Science and Technology at the University of the West Indies.
It is south of Jamaica, expected to make a north and then northeast turn, which would take it right over the country. We are in the cone of influence, so we have been seeing some effects, but bracing for the worst.
So obviously flash flooding is a major concern, with rainfall predictions coming not in inches but in feet, more than 2 feet, I see. Is that still the prediction?
Yes, the amount of rainfall we're expected to get will be catastrophic. Also, the wind impact we are bracing for, the wind strengths are expected to be equally catastrophic. The speed at which it's moving would mean we'd be under this for quite a while. Storm surge is also the other impact, especially on our coastal areas, especially with the strength of the storm.
Right. And as you move north of the southern coast, there are the mountains in the interior of Jamaica. Are landslides a concern as well?
Yes. And this, of course, comes out of the fact that for the past, I would say, month, 2 months, we have had quite a bit of rain already, you know, and so the soils are extremely saturated.
Right. So sea surface temperatures around Jamaica, I've seen, are unusually warm now. How much has that contributed to Melissa's rapid intensification into a Cat 5 storm?
One of the things is clearly the exceptional sea surface temperatures, you have said, not only at the surface, but the depth of the warmth as well. This means not only is there enormous moisture to feed, atmospheric moisture to feed in to the storm, but the fuel, therefore, and I think we are seeing this play out. The other characteristic clearly is that rapid intensification, a key feature of storms in this kind of climate era. And then a number of papers have already pointed to is the slow speed of the storm. That's the other kind of scientific element that makes Melissa fit into the characteristic of storms of a climate warming era.
So how are Jamaicans handling what I imagine is a very scary, upsetting situation?
We're doing our best from the kind of government level. We have had daily briefings from our various disaster agencies, our Met services. Disaster coordinators are on standby. We have been declared a threatened area. Mandatory evacuation orders are out there. You know, all the critical infrastructure that you will need to recover is being put in place. Shelters have been opened. Lots of public awareness. On a personal level, you know, people have been doing the best that they can. We went through Barry last year, so people were almost on a heightened awareness. Here it is happening again so quickly. You have your batteries to stay informed, buy battery radio when the power goes, all the kind of personal things, storing water, you know, charging your power banks have been put in place. So people are trying to handle this as best as possible.
You mentioned Hurricane Beryl last year, and some experts are looking at Hurricane Melissa's characteristics and saying this is more and more what storms on our warming planet will look like. Is that analysis shared by you?
Absolutely. Melissa has all the characteristics, I think, of what a storm in the climate warming era does look like. You expect storms in the climate warming era to rapidly intensify. This did this. There's new science to suggest you expect them to slow down. This also did this. This, I think, will be our third Category 5 for this season. You know, that's a characteristic in you'd expect in a climate warming era. The fact that we're in this again, just 1 year out, you know, with this kind of intensity, seems the frequency of very strong storms, not necessarily more storms, but very strong, seems to be a characteristic of a climate warming era. Definitely, there are a number of characteristics that, you know, I would suggest have the climate warming signal or imprint.
Can you describe the highest risk communities and what they're facing as Melissa closes in on landfall?
Jamaica, if you know, has a very mountainous interior. And then we have these narrow coastal plains, you know, and we're not a very large island. So risk comes from various parts in various ways. Definitely the South Coast communities, because they are all in this coastal plain. That's where, you know, the capital city, Kingston, is. But then there are several other major cities. That's where, you know, much of our major infrastructure, our hospitals, our power plants, et cetera, are located. And some of them are very low-lying. So, for example, Portmore, which is close to Kingston. But then you can also go to the South Coast, which really suffered under Barry last year, in the west, the western South Coast. But then there is also the people who live on the mountain interior. You know, lots of life takes place there. And there, the risk now is not just the storm surge and the coastal flooding, but now is the landslide risk. There's also the risk for the North Coast, which is our tourism capital as well. Just the geography of Jamaica puts the risk almost everywhere. It's just a different kind of risk.
So, Michael, I've heard reports that some communities near the coast were not evacuating. Has that idea that these hurricanes are getting more intense and that they are the new norm and will only get worse, has that trickled down to the majority of the population?
Well, the truth is, I think, you know, how we have been manifesting, how we've been experiencing climate change, including in these extreme events, I would almost want to say climate has been making its own case. So there is a level, a strong level of awareness of climate change and these strong storms and what they are likely to do. But there are people, you know, for various reasons that will not evacuate. And they're not all, what I would say, just being stubborn. You know, people want to hold on to their properties. These are things that have great meaning, you know, to them. There's always the threat that when you move out, others may take advantage of the storm, to, you know, in those kinds of ways. And then, of course, you have a memory that, well, I survived the last one, and you hold on to that memory. So there are people who are, for various reasons, are staying in place. We really do want them to evacuate, especially when they are at the coastal communities. But I would hasten to add that there, even those who are staying in place, there is an awareness of, I think, of the danger and the risk involved.
Jamaica and climate scientist Michael Taylor, he heads the Faculty of Science and Technology at the University of the West Indies in Kingston. Thank you very much, Michael, and please stay safe.
Thank you. Thank you for thinking about us, and we hope, you know, it will get the word out about climate change and its impact on small islands.
We're doing what we can. Thank you very much.
Okay. Take care.
President Trump is in Asia this week, and he sounds decidedly upbeat about trade talks with China. Administration officials say they've reached a framework for an agreement with Chinese negotiators. There is a lot riding on a meeting this Thursday between Trump and Chinese leader Xi Jinping. But as the world's Matthew Bell reports, U.S. allies and partners across Asia are watching closely, too.
Malaysia was President Trump's first stop on this trip, and that's where he sought to play the role of peacemaker. Trump took part in a signing ceremony between Cambodia and Thailand. The two Southeast Asian neighbors fought a short war in July. And on Sunday, the president took credit for brokering a peace agreement.
A momentous day for all of the people of Southeast Asia as we sign a historic agreement to end the military conflict between Cambodia and Thailand. I held phone calls with both leaders. I was actually at Turnberry in Scotland when I did this.
Trump said he remembers that it was a beautiful day, but that spending time on peace building was more important than playing golf at his resort. Malaysia's Prime Minister Anwar Ibrahim hosted the signing ceremony, and he thanked Trump, describing him as someone who's willing to break the rules.
When President arrived, he asked me to join him in the car. I said, that's against the security and protocol rules. And he was delighted to break the rules, and I...
That's right.
It was a nice ride. And we share a lot of things in common. I was in prison, but he almost got there.
One Southeast Asia expert I spoke with told me that neither Cambodia or Thailand wanted to escalate their border skirmish. They couldn't afford to. On the whole, Southeast Asia is downgrading its economic forecast for growth because of Trump's tariffs. At the same time, leaders across Asia, for the most part, like seeing U.S. engagement, and they almost always see a visit by an American president as an opportunity.
The expectations are high.
Victor Cha is the president of geopolitics at the Center for Strategic and International Studies. He also served as director of Asian Affairs at the White House National Security Council under George W. Bush. Cha spoke with me from Japan, where he says everyone is hoping for Trump's meeting with Xi Jinping on Thursday to go well.
Japan has no interest in seeing the United States and China engage in an all-out trade war. That's not to Japan's advantage. So seeing a de-escalation in this ramping up of trade sanctions is something I think Japan has an interest in and would see in a positive direction. The other important thing in Japan, of course, is they've just elected a new leader, Sanae Takeuchi. And this will be the first meeting between her, Japan's first female prime minister, and Trump. And so for Japan, the Japanese, where I am currently situated, this is a very big moment.
Trump said he thinks Takeuchi will be great as Japan's prime minister. But Victor Cha says there's a feeling in Japan that its most reliable global partner is a lot less predictable. In the past, a visit by the U.S. president would be preceded by weeks or months of high-level meetings that set specific deliverables. That's not how things work now, though.
In the second Trump administration, there is a lot more unpredictability because in the end, the president himself has to personally okay even the smallest detail. There's a lot of hurry up and wait, if you will. And never certainty as to whether the deal that you just negotiated at the expert policymaking level will actually be the deal that's accepted because Trump personally has to okay these things.
Cha says Japanese leaders are hoping that U.S.-China tensions can be eased this week and at the same time that Trump will not forget about Japan's security concerns. Tokyo accuses Beijing of violating its airspace and taking more aggressive actions in the South China Sea, including against Taiwan. The government in South Korea is dealing with a similar dynamic, as President Trump says he's open to meeting again with North Korea's leader Kim Jong-un while he's in Asia this week.
I got along great with Kim Jong-un. I liked him. He liked me. If he wants to meet, I'll be in South Korea.
South Korea's President Lee Jae-myung has said he likes the idea, too. James Kim is a Korea expert at the Stimson Center in Washington.
President Lee's already stated and he's committed to this idea of trying to engage more constructively with North Korea. He would like to see the tensions die down and the dialogue channels to reopen so that the South Korean officials can engage with the North Korean officials.
Kim says there are risks for South Korea, though, especially if Trump and Kim Jong-un conduct substantive talks without President Lee at the table. But the North Korean leader has been pretty clear. He says he won't meet with Trump unless Washington drops its demand for North Korea to give up its nuclear weapons. James Kim says it's unlikely that a last-minute Trump-Kim summit would be able to accomplish anything major, but he says it could be the start of something bigger. For The World, I'm Matthew Bell.
You're listening to The World. This is The World. I'm Marco Werman. Now to Spain for a music story. It starts with a 5-year-old boy leaving home to make a name for himself as a singer. Yes, leaving home at the age of 5. As The World's Jerry Haddon recently found out when he caught up with the singer, that's just the start of his incredible story.
1950s Spain was poor. The country was still reeling from its civil war and isolated on the world stage. In the countryside, food was scarce. This was the world José Jiménez Fernández was born into. My dad worked in the olive orchards, he says. He earned enough to buy us a loaf of bread a day. My mom would boil up some herbs that she managed to grow. That's how we survived. On that and on this. This is José singing as a kid. The song, The Mockingbird, earned him a nickname, Joselito the Mockingbird, and some extra food.
A los 4 y 5 años, yo salía corriendo para cantarles un fandango.
When I was like 4 or 5 years old, he tells me, from his home near Valencia, I'd head down to the village olive press and sing fandangos for the workers. In exchange, they'd gather up some bread, soak it in olive oil, then wrap it in paper for me to take home. This was near Jaén in Andalucía in Spain's south. Joselito was still just the little kid from town with the big voice. Then he says he had an idea.
Yo pasaba mucha hambre y me ganaba más dinero que mi padre cavando olivos de sol a sol.
We were so hungry, he says, and I was earning more money singing than my father working. So one day I told my mom I was leaving for Valencia with my older brother, Antonio, who'd found a job in construction. Antonio was 12, Joselito in kindergarten. We set off on my brother's old bicycle, he says, me seated on the back. We'd do maybe 15 miles a day. We'd stop at inns along the way, and I'd sing. The owners would give us dinner and shelter, he says, because it was the dead of winter. I asked Joselito if he was scared. I mean, he was 5, it was freezing, the trip took like 2 weeks, and they didn't even know where they were going to live.
Yo no sentía miedo de eso, sentía miedo de quedarme.
I wasn't afraid, he tells me. What really scared me, he says, was not leaving. Plus, he says, before setting out, he made a promise to his mother that he'd come back for her, a millionaire.
El pico se estaba andando dos tortolas en un almendro y el pico se estaba andando la miraba y me reía.
Soon after reaching Valencia, Joselito sang at a talent show. He brought the house down, he recounts. Next thing he knows, a famous Spanish tenor, Luis Mariano, is taking him to Paris. There I performed live on color TV, he says. Back in Spain, we didn't even have black and white television yet. I became famous first in Paris. But within no time, he was back in Spain and making movies, a trilogy at first, showcasing his singing. They were a hit at home, in Latin America, and in the U.S.
Now, ladies and gentlemen, this is Joselito, who's 10 years old. How about a wonderful New York salute for him? This is Joselito.
That was none other than renowned TV host Ed Sullivan. After that, I started traveling around the world, Joselito says, 9 months out of the year, earning $5,000 a show. The lines were so long, he says, I was doing up to 8 shows a day. A quick check on the math there, and yep, it all added up to enough for Joselito to keep his promise to his mom. He moved her and the rest of his siblings to Valencia, set them up in houses, gave them money to start businesses. Thing was, though, Joselito was still really young, green, you might say. He fell prey to gold-digging associates and to drugs. He ended up in jail for 5 years for cocaine possession. He calls it a stain on a life otherwise well-lived, something he rarely talks about. Nor do I want to get into it now, he says. It was really a hard time. But prison, he says, actually helped me free myself from that hell I was trapped in. He was in his 50s when he got out of jail. He continued to perform, but less. He pretty much fell out of the limelight. Today, Joselito is 82. He lives in the same Valencian town he reached at age 5. He's not rich, but he's comfortable. He's got his wife and grown kids, plus a street nearby named after him. I ask him, and how can I not, to sing a line or two from the Mockingbird years, to which he replies, not going to happen. First of all, because I'm old now, he says, but also because I respect Joselito the Mockingbird more than anyone, and I don't want to taint his memory. I want to leave my younger self as I was, he says, that flawless kid with that astounding voice. For The World, I'm Jerry Haddon, Barcelona.
Today in England, a new memorial was dedicated to LGBTQ military personnel. Sitting in the front row at the unveiling in Staffordshire was none other than King Charles. It marked his first official demonstration of explicit support for the LGBTQ community. Music played as the bronze memorial was revealed, a sculpture titled An Opened Letter. It resembles a rumpled sheet of paper with words once used to incriminate people cut into the bronze. The LGBTQ community was banned from the UK military until 2000. For decades before that, people who were gay or just perceived to be gay were investigated, dismissed, and in some cases sent to prison. Porugini Rahalik served in the Women's Royal Air Force. Her service ended abruptly when it was discovered that she had a girlfriend. She told the BBC that led to intrusive investigations.
They searched my room. Well, they turned it upside down, stripped the bed, threw the mattress on the floor, emptied out books. Eventually, after 5 or so hours, I just gave up, said, yes, it's true. You know, it wasn't just my job. I lost my home, I lost my friends, I lost my future.
Since the ban was lifted 25 years ago, the LGBTQ community has pushed the government to make reparations. The new memorial is part of that effort. So are financial reparations. Veterans who suffered under the ban can apply for payments of up to $93,000. But time is running out, so says Peter Gibson, CEO of the charity Fighting With Pride.
Their reparations have to be claimed before December of next year. So our guiding mission through till December next year is to seek out every single one of those missing LGBT veterans and put them on that journey home.
Peter Gibson there speaking with the BBC. Veterans at the dedication today of the new memorial, they say it's helping them get closure. They also say they hope it serves as a reminder of what they endured while serving their country. In Cameroon, protests over election results are about more than election results.
The school system is collapsing. The hospitals are collapsing. The infrastructure is collapsing. Why would they not be upset?
That story just ahead. You're listening to The World. This is The World. I'm Marco Werman. Elections have concluded in Cameroon, and the results are in. 92-year-old Paul Biya will once again lead the country for the eighth time in a row. Biya is one of only two leaders the nation in Central Africa has ever had. But this election was different. A major opposition candidate emerged in Issa Chiroma Bakary, and protests have erupted over the results, leaving at least four people dead. Julius Amin is a Cameroonian scholar and professor of African history at the University of Dayton, Ohio. You are not in Cameroon, Julius, at the moment, but what are you hearing about the situation on the ground there right now?
For the past 2 weeks, I've been following up things, and people are shocked. There's a sense of disbelief and just wondering what things are going to be like. There's a sense of fear. Where's the country going? So these are the type of things I'm hearing from Cameroon right now.
What's the sense of disbelief about? What are people unable to believe?
You started by saying Paul Biya is 92 years old, and somehow a lot of people probably suspected that this is the way it's going to turn out because this has been the nature of elections in Cameroon for many years.
Julius, let's try and capture the Paul Biya story. I mean, he is the oldest serving head of state in the world. How did he first come to power in post-independence Cameroon?
Paul Biya has been in the high echelons of government forever, for a long time. And so when he became president in 1982, what happened is that people looked at him as a breath of fresh air because the first president was equally repressive. Press freedom came in. There was an exchange to try to start some schools. Then a few years after that, Paul Biya changed.
What you say, though, rings true because I was in West Africa in the 1980s and Biya was seen as the head of a relatively stable government, a country that had its problems but was doing okay. So what's your quick analysis of what happened during these past four decades of leadership? How did he stay in power for so long?
Well, Paul Biya stayed in power for a very long time because of the ability to rig elections. He was in power for, what, over 10 years? Then he said, you know what, the term of a president has to be limited to two terms. When he served additional two terms, the election was changed, that true democracies don't have term limits. This was his argument.
Right. So that opposition candidate, Issa Chiroma Bakary, who is he and how significant is the support for him?
It is very interesting in that he served in the Paul Biya government. There are so many flashpoints now taking place. One of the flashpoints is in the English-speaking region, trying to separate from the government. Chiroma was this key spokesman of the government.
Right.
When it all started that, you know what? People who are in the English-speaking section have been deceived. Anglophones have been treated well. They should not complain. He came out when he started running for president. He said he was misled, that he was deceived. And so to an extent, this may also be a case of chickens coming home to roost.
Julius, you alluded to something there a moment ago that is not a subtext. It's really important to what's happening in Cameroon right now. And that's the fact that the country has a language divide. You're from the English-speaking part of the country. Paul Biya is from the French-speaking region. And Francophones dominate the political scene. How serious is that tension at the moment in Cameroon?
This is a major problem. This is one of the reasons why there's an Anglophone protest taking place. When English-speaking Cameroon and French-speaking Cameroon got together, when they became united, one of the things stated very clearly is that English and French will be treated equally. I'm a researcher, and I've been looking at thousands of documents, significant documents of the country. They're all in French. Today, when the Constitutional Committee was reading the result, everything was in French. The English language doesn't matter. This has been a fundamental problem. That's why I said earlier that there are different flashpoints in the country. The Anglophone section is in a crisis. In the north, there's Boko Haram. Now, Chiroma comes out of the north. What a terrible miscalculation to go after him. Does the administration want to create another flashpoint in the north? They need to think carefully.
How big a factor is his age? Like, how's his health and mental capacity?
Paul Biya's health is a taboo. People don't talk about it. There's very little that comes out, but you can make some deductions just by seeing him walk to places. He's 92. He seems tired. I'm not a physician, but I just look at him, I can draw some conclusions.
Julius, it was actually difficult to find anyone in Cameroon who's willing to go on the record at the moment, suggesting a level of concern if one is there and speaks honestly about the situation. As I said earlier, you're not there, but as a Cameroonian, how do you feel about what's happening in your country right now?
I said earlier that I love this country. I'm angry. I'm outraged. When I see young people in the streets, I see myself in them. I am one of them. If I was in Cameroon right now, I probably, as a young person like that, I'll be one of them because I'll be unemployed. I'll be, as a young person, down the streets. So I see the fact that they don't have some of the opportunities I had growing up in Cameroon. I went to undergraduate in Cameroon. I did my schooling until I came to the U.S. for grad school in Cameroon. These opportunities are no longer there. The school system is collapsing. The hospitals are collapsing. The infrastructure is collapsing. There's a sense of hopelessness. Why would they not be upset? To say that the opposition is inflaming the young people represents a misreading of what is really happening. The young people are in the streets. Yes, they're angry because there's a sense that the elections have been rigged. But they're angry because they don't have jobs. They are hungry. The kids cannot go to school. And this is the feeling I hear from people. How do we survive this? There is no guarantee that it was someone else, that the person would have done things differently. But the young people right now want to see some other ideas.
That was Julius Amin, professor of African history at the University of Dayton in Ohio. He's from Cameroon. And sticking with the election theme, Ireland has voted in a new president. Catherine Connolly, a left-leaning lawmaker, won in a landslide over the weekend. Connolly is 68 and is known for outspoken views on everything from the war in Gaza to the U.S. presidency. Her role as head of state is largely ceremonial, but Ireland's main opposition parties say her win is a clear sign of what Irish voters want: change. The World's Europe correspondent, Orla Barry, has more.
The race to become president of Ireland started out with a colourful cast of characters. There was Irish-American dancer Michael Flatley, Live Aid organiser Bob Geldof, and UFC fighter Conor McGregor. But by polling day, two women were leading the field: Heather Humphreys, a former centre-right government minister, and independent MP Catherine Connolly.
We need a president that uses her voice for peace in the world. A president that says diplomacy is important, and a president that calls out genocide for what it is.
Connolly, who has the demeanour of a contemplative nun, has been a fierce critic of Israel's actions in Gaza. She's also a staunch defender of Irish neutrality and has condemned what she sees as Europe's increased militarisation. England, France and the US cannot be trusted, she once said, because of their arms industries. Heather Humphreys, her opponent, said those sorts of comments made her unfit for the job of head of state.
You've insulted Germany, you've insulted France, you've insulted the UK, our nearest neighbour, you've insulted the US. So that doesn't go without consequences.
But Connolly has proven to be a hit with voters of all ages in Ireland. She grew up in a family of 14 in Galway on the West Coast and is passionate about the Irish language.
It's a beautiful language. It gives you a perspective on the world that's utterly different than the English language. I don't think there's the false distinction in the Irish language between the human being and nature. It's one.
Kneecap, the Irish-speaking rap trio from Belfast, backed her candidacy, as did a bloc of left-wing parties, including Irish Republican Party Sinn Féin. On Saturday, Mary Lou MacDonald, the Sinn Féin leader, said Connolly's victory was a warning to government.
We have two objectives, I've said it all along, to have a marvellous, independent, incredible, articulate woman in the park. We've achieved that. And the next job is to get Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael out of government.
Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael, two centre-right parties, make up Ireland's ruling coalition. Political analysts, though, say the Sinn Féin leader may be jumping the gun.
People are looking for different things in a president than they are in a prime minister.
Gail McElroy is a political science professor at Trinity College Dublin.
The presidential role is largely ceremonial, so voters feel free to vote as a protest against the incumbent government, or alternatively vote entirely differently for a character that they will see will be a unifying, symbolic representative of the country.
Sinn Féin is right to say that some voters are unhappy, McElroy says. 13% of them spoiled their ballots, a record high in Ireland. And McElroy, who was at one of the count centres on Saturday, saw lots of examples of that.
I couldn't really repeat on this program much of what I saw. Some of them were, you know, the usual none of the above or a big extra, but I saw various body parts on many, many spoiled ballots. And some people were very, very inventive. People clearly went in with coloured pens and drew Irish flags on their ballots and so on and so forth.
Now that the election is over, Connolly supporters may be wondering if she'll continue to speak her mind. During the campaign, she described the US president as volatile, unpredictable, and a bully. Asked recently if she'd greet President Trump if he visited Ireland, she said,
If I have to do that as president, that's part of the role.
Political analysts say Connolly will probably choose her battles very carefully.
She's going to keep her powder dry, so she won't be speaking out every day of the week about matters that she may disagree with or that she may wish to promote.
Barry Colfer is with the Institute of International and European Affairs, a Dublin-based think tank.
But I think on the topics that we know her for, things around foreign policy, things around social policy, including housing, things around neutrality, things around the Irish language, I expect she won't have any issue speaking up, even when she knows that her purview in these areas are very limited.
On Saturday, Catherine Connolly vowed to be an inclusive president and a voice for peace. The Irish government is probably hoping she sticks to that promise. For The World, I'm Orla Barry.
We live in a hyper-connected world where messages travel across the globe instantaneously. The devices they travel on can translate those messages if the language is foreign to us. But not everyone on Earth has access to this kind of communication, and some don't want it. There are about 200 groups of indigenous peoples on this planet who intentionally have not made contact with the outside world, and they are under severe threat.
Every single uncontacted people and group in the world is facing some kind of threat against them or their land.
That's Caroline Pierce. She's executive director of Survival International, an indigenous rights organization that just published a report forecasting that about half the world's uncontacted peoples could be wiped out within a decade. Pierce explained why from London.
The nature of contact for indigenous peoples who are having contact forced onto them by outsiders is disease. It's loss of their land. It's loss of their autonomy and self-determination. These are peoples who live very self-sufficiently, who know how to use their forests. They all live in forests. They know how to use their forests sustainably and well. They're not living in ignorance. They're well aware of the colonizing forces that are trying to take over their land and, you know, make contact with them. And they are making an active choice to reject that. It's a perfectly rational choice to make, and it's their choice to make.
So we'll get into the specifics in a moment. But first, when your report believes that half of these groups could be wiped out in under a decade, what kinds of threats are they up against?
The major threat is from extractive industries. Logging is huge. 64% of these groups are having their lands encroached upon, invaded by logging right now. Mining is also a huge threat, more than 40% mining. Agribusiness is a big one, particularly in the Amazon, but not only. And then drug traffickers, actually, in the Amazon Basin is a huge one. More than a third of the groups are being exposed to drug traffickers who are operating on a really industrial scale. So that's a real danger. And then one of the new threats we point to is from, you know, would-be social media influencers and stars who are desperate to achieve some kind of first contact on camera.
Wow. And
achieve notoriety that way. But if they bring a cold, the flu, simple infections that are common outside to indigenous peoples, they could wipe out an entire people. So, you know, it's not fun and games.
Logging, mining, agribusiness, the main culprits, according to report, and these industries are crowding out peoples out of the territories they inhabit. How does that happen, though? Like if a mining company, for example, wants to dig up the ground for some resource, where and who are they negotiating with?
So it depends on the country, because there are much stronger protections in some countries than others. In Indonesia, for example, where there's very limited official recognition of indigenous people's rights, there are mining companies operating very legally in indigenous territory and in territory of uncontacted peoples. So the Honggana Manyawa on Halmahera Island in Indonesia, for example, there are now 19 nickel mining concessions on their land, which are trying to mine nickel to make batteries for electric cars. So it's supposedly a sustainable industry, but it's actually destroying these people's forest and putting them at great risk. in the Amazon, particularly in the Brazilian Amazon, that land is recognized and protected and no activity is allowed. But you do have these illegal gold miners, it's gold, a lot of it in the Amazon, as well as some other metals, who are going in and operating. And when you think of illegal miners, you might think of something small scale, but these are really people operating with industrial bulldozers, excavators. They're often linked to the drug trafficking gangs, and there needs to be a really concerted effort and money and resources put towards making sure they don't operate.
What are the protections you see in these cases in South America that indigenous uncontacted people can protect themselves with?
Well, uncontacted peoples themselves are, as we've noted, making a very active choice to do this. This is not they're not existing in passivity, far less in ignorance of what is happening outside. They're making a very active choice, and they are sending a message even without contact. They often leave things like crossed spears on their hunting trails to ward people off to say it's their territory. They create booby traps. What is also happening is that they have many indigenous neighbors who are supporting them very powerfully, who are speaking out, who are monitoring the land, who are reporting back when there are incursions, who are breaking up roads, destroying roads that loggers and so on are creating into the heart of the Amazon. So there's a very strong indigenous fight back. And what we as the rest of the world need to do is put pressure both on governments and on the companies that might be mining, and on further down the supply chain. There may be gold miners operating illegally, but that gold is coming into what is seen as perfectly legal supply chains and is being traded on the open market. So we need far, far more careful and thoughtful and active response from governments, from companies, and from industry bodies to ensure that there are not resources from uncontacted people's territories that are coming into supply chains and that are being bought by consumers in the global north.
So there is a framework in international law known as FPIC, free, prior, and informed consent. What does that mean for outsiders who want to have actual face-to-face contact with uncontacted people? And if that's not enough protection, what more needs to be done?
Well, I mean, the principle is very strong. I mean, the free, prior, and informed consent, FPIC, as we often call it, principle is very strong. And it has been elaborated many times by the United Nations and other related bodies that FPIC principle means that for uncontacted peoples, there cannot be any activity on their land because without consent, they cannot be contacted. And without contact, you cannot get consent. And that together means that there is no way that is legal under international law to have any incursion into activity on or attempts at making contact with uncontacted peoples. So the principle is strong. It does come down to a matter of enforcement. And as we say, governments need to do more. But in the interim, we're also calling on companies and industries to do more and to clean up their act.
Caroline Pierce is the executive director of Survival International. We reached her in London. This is The World. I'm Marco Werman. The coastline of Greenland is known for glaciers and rugged rocky terrain, but it's also home to at least a dozen ghost towns, small settlements that the Danish government shut down in the 1950s and 60s. At the time, the government wanted to consolidate the population, so they withdrew services to the far-flung communities and encouraged the people there to move away. But as my co-host Carolyn Beeler discovered on a reporting trip to Greenland this summer, the word abandoned doesn't tell the entire story.
The easiest way to get to the abandoned settlement of Kornak is by a tourist water taxi from Nuuk, the capital of Greenland.
We'll be sailing over here and into the fjord this way.
The first mate points out a tiny island on a map of the Nuuk Fjord.
That's where we're going. That's a former settlement.
You sail for a little over an hour between towering mountain peaks, past a waterfall tumbling over jagged rock, and by icebergs the size of houses. When you scramble off the boat onto the rocky shoreline of Kornak, you can see maybe a few dozen tidy A-frame homes. And that is when you realize that this village, it does not really look abandoned.
A lot of the houses here look very well kept. Most of them I'm seeing have solar panels on them. Couple of Greenlandic flags waving.
Oh, there is somebody.
I walk up a footpath worn into the tall grass to a bright blue house. What's your name, ma'am?
Victoria Martens. I was born and grown up here, but my parents had to move to town.
Town means nuke. Martin's family moved away in 1971 when the government shut down the community, but she's been coming back seasonally for decades.
And many of the people here, we live in nuke, so we use the houses here as summer cottage. So we're always here in summertime.
It's a very beautiful place.
We have electricity by sun.
Solar electricity.
Yes, and freezer, so I can live here many months.
But no stores, no hospital, no electricity from the grid. No running water either, so they use outhouses and capture glacial meltwater. Do you miss living here year-round?
Yeah. Most of the people who lived here before missed to be here.
After World War II, the Danish government and local officials started moving people from small fishing villages like Qaarnaaq to bigger cities. The settlements lacked modern infrastructure and were expensive to maintain.
In order to gather the population, in order to gather workforce, a lot of old settlements, they were shut down.
This is Oyemmiwak Engel, the head of the Nuuk Local Museum.
Some of them were shut down more forcefully than others. In some places, they just stopped coming out with resources for the stores. And that was what happened with Qaarnaaq, for instance.
The general store was shut down, as were the school and church. Mail delivery stopped. But the island was never totally abandoned, Engel says.
The funny thing about Qaarnaaq is that there were always people.
Some with the means just traveled between the island and Nuuk. Others stayed put.
The same thing happened in some of the other settlements that were closed down in the 50s and 60s and 70s, up and down all of Greenland's coasts.
With no stores on Qaarnaaq, hunting and fishing are especially popular. It's reindeer season when I visit. Can hear the gunshots echoing around the fjord. Victoria Martens relies on trips back to Nuuk for food and neighbors who bring her supplies. While we talk, her eyes drift over to a boat heading our way.
My friend's coming here with my things from Nuuk, so I had to go down.
After they're done carrying bags up from the boat, I talk to those friends, Nikolai McKeeson and Susanna Kreutzmann-Peterson. McKeeson's dad worked at a fish processing plant here before it was closed.
It was sad, of course, but time to move to live another life.
The couple comes here to enjoy the stunning scenery and to hunt. We're standing on their porch talking near reindeer carcasses hung up to dry.
The silence and the nature and ice. Tomorrow it's going to be storm. Every kind of weather is beautiful. And this windows here. It's our television. Just hear the sound of birds.
I ask Oyemmiwak Engel what she makes of the fact that people are still living on Qaarnaaq despite government efforts to shut it down.
I think it says a lot about the, I was about to say tenacity of our people, of our culture, but maybe it's more like the resilience.
There is a dark side to this history. Engel and I are talking at the museum where she works, and she points to a photo of a huge modern apartment block that's hanging on the wall. It was built in Nuuk to house people relocated from Qaarnaaq and other small settlements, and it was nothing like where they'd come from.
We can almost physically see where it went wrong, how people who had previously been either the greater hunter or the greatest fisher were completely stripped of that identity and had to sort of scramble to find a new one and find a place in the big city where they did not feel at home, where they did not feel welcome.
The trauma caused by relocation is seen as part of the reason why Greenland has high rates of depression, alcohol abuse, and suicide.
We're still dealing with a lot of that trauma. We're still dealing with people who feel a sense of not belonging, and that has been passed down into generations.
Today, dozens of small settlements are still scattered around Greenland, some with as few as a handful of residents. Official government relocation policies are a thing of the past, but there is an ongoing debate about how to keep these communities running. It is expensive, for instance, to run a school for just a few kids. For now, in Coronach, it's residents themselves who are basically running things. Susanna Kreutzmann-Peterson shows me the church that locals banded together to restore.
People come here to get married and sometimes Easter. Mm.
It's lovely, these bright blue pews and...
We also have a little museum.
She offers to give me a tour, but I have to scramble to catch the boat back to Nuuk.
See you.
Thank you, bye. Just like everyone here will have to do before winter fully sets in. For The World, Carolyn Beeler, Coronach, Greenland.
The World is produced by GBH and PRX, broadcasting weekdays from the Nan and Bill Harris Studio in Boston and from the Department of Communication at UC San Diego. Find us online anytime at theworld.org. We're also on YouTube at The World News GBH, all one word. Check us out there and be sure to subscribe. Have a good rest of your day and join us right back here tomorrow.
The World is supported by the Carnegie Corporation of New York, working to reduce political polarization through philanthropic support for education, democracy, and peace. More information at carnegie.org. By the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. MacFound.org. And by FJC, a foundation of philanthropic funds serving the nonprofit sector with donor-advised funds, fiscal sponsorship, bridge lending, and more. FJC.org. The World's theme music is composed by Ned Porter. The World is a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX. More information at theworld.org.